Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here, your host on Stand to Reason. Thank you so much for being part of our show here. And Tuesday now, I'm doing 2 hours. I've been gone a couple of weeks. Was I gone 2 weeks? Was I gone 2 weeks? Last week? No, just last week. And I'll next week, too, because I'll be in Kentucky. Yeah, anyway, here I am. I'm here today. Although we have fill-ins when I'm gone, and a lot of times it's me that have, it is I that has put together a show for you in my absence. And sometimes those are a little shy of 1 hour segments, but that's okay. It's what I've got. No callers. I'm just talking about some things or maybe doing an interview. So maybe you haven't missed me, but I've missed you. And the same thing next week because I'll be in Kentucky. Might as well tell you about that just so you know. And I am not good at promoting my own events. When I go to those events, I run into people who found out about them, and I'm glad they did. But I have dropped the ball a number of times. And so let me just take care of this right away. This coming weekend, Saturday, March 14th and 15th, I will be back in Ohio. I was at Cedarville University 3 weeks ago, and I'm going to be back in the Dayton, Ohio area at Christian Life Center, okay? Christian Life Center in Dayton, Ohio on March 14th and March 15th. I'll be talking a lot about taking Jesus seriously, and that's on the docket and some other things. I think we have Q&A and maybe some other talks, but that's going to be Saturday night and Sunday. So Christian Life Center coming up March 14th and 15th. On Tuesday, the 17th, so I'm just going to fly to Detroit and then from Dayton and then pop down to Louisville, Kentucky at the REACH conference. It's, you can find out information at kybaptist.org because this is a big Baptist enterprise, and I'm really looking forward to that too. REACH conference at kybaptist.org. As in Kentucky, kybaptist.org, all the information there. That'll be Tuesday, March 17th. I will be focusing, for my part, a lot on the tactics material, so I love teaching that and usually well-received by the people. And then Saturday, March 21st, so as soon as they get back next week from Louisville, I'll be home a day, and then I fly out on Saturday, March 21st, to Elk Grove, California, at St. Peter's Lutheran Church. And you can find info at stpetersEG.org, stpetersEG.org. So looking forward to that as well. I don't recall what I'm teaching on there, but anyway, go to str.org and find my face and check my schedule and the details. The details are there. So little update. Last time I was on the air, I asked for prayer. Oh, that's why I wasn't here last week, because I was in surgery. I'd asked for prayer regarding my surgery, and I just have to tell you, I was so moved by the number of responses I got. I mean, gazillions on my Facebook. I've never got so many responses, I don't think. And people were so sweet and everything that they said and they're praying and all that. It's just great. We got a lot of calls here at the office. And I had just kind of mentioned it in passing and then put a little note on my Facebook. And you all were so fabulous. I want to thank you for that. And there was kind of an odd answer to your prayer. So I'm just taking what happened as from the Lord. But they got me in, and basically what I was getting was an angio. What was I getting? Not an angio. I was getting an ablation. There it is. It started with an A. Then ablation is when you have a little electrical problem in your heart that causes, for example, AFib, atrial fibrillation, whatever. And that's what I get on occasion. I'll get it in the evening, and then it'll go away in the morning sometimes, and it's intermittent. But it's not good because it could cause blood clots because you're blood pools and when your heart flutters around a little bit. And so anyway, I just thought I'd get this taken care of. A lot of people have had it. My sister's had it 3 times. My brother-in-law's had it. Lots of people contacted me, said I had it, and it's a fairly safe procedure, even though they're poking around in your heart with wires. So I went in on Tuesday morning for that, wheeled me into a room where they're going to basically put a camera down my throat. I never heard of this thing. It's called a TEE, all right? transesophageal something or other, all right? And it's a basically a throat TV. It should be TTV. They put a TV camera down your throat. Then from the backside, they look at your heart. And they want to make sure there's no clots in there, because they don't want to be poking around and freeing up a clot, and then you got a mess. Okay, you got a stroke or something like that. So, and after they've done that, then they go and then they run the wires up from both legs, and they double check a little bit with the legs with an ultrasound to make sure there's no clots in the legs. And what ended up in my case is I got wheeled into the TV down your throat room, and I was all hooked up. They started pushing the stuff. Everything's got dizzy, and I was gone. And the next thing I remember, I'm in the recovery room with a sore throat because it's a scratchy TV going down. And I asked, they said, were there any clots? Well, it turns out my heart was in great shape. And they checked my right side before they went into the vein there. And that was clear. And so they're checking the left while they're slicing my right and going to put the wire up to go into my heart. And then the catheter. And as they were looking at the left side, they found what they thought was a clot. So they had to stop everything because they can't go further. They're going to push a wire past a clot, and that's no good. And so when I woke up, basically, I just had a little hole in my hip, and that's it. So what they did is they put me through a bunch more tests, got a CT scan of all my legs, and then I had a very thorough ultrasound of both legs. It turns out they didn't find anything. So maybe that's a false call. I don't know. But it's good to find out and make sure, and better safe than sorry in this case. As long as they're poking around in veins and in your heart and stuff, you want to be clean before they go up. But I don't know the situation now. So I'm just taking this delay as an answer to prayer, because maybe there is something that needs to be addressed. And I have a post-op tomorrow, and I'll talk to my doctor, who I didn't get to talk to after the surgery was postponed. I guess he went out for coffee, had the morning off. And so I'll talk to him tomorrow and find out what's going on. Still need the operation, and so I'll keep you posted, and I'd love to have your prayers again. But I'm feeling fine. I was just a little groggy for the day, and everything healed up. That little puncture wound healed up fine. I'm okay. I still got the AFib concern, but hasn't happened since then, but still got to deal with that. So we'll see. We'll see what's coming up. I also have a little problem with my left arm. I think I might have torn a rotator cuff, so I'm going to the doctor to have that looked at, too. And you know what? I'm almost 70, a couple of months away, and things are just falling apart. I'm trying to do my best I can to keep them together, but that's just what happens. My younger brother said, you know, Greg, it ain't going to get any better, just going to get worse. And I guess that's the way it is. But I'm not hanging up my cleats yet, friends. I plan to be in the harness for a while, so God willing, and the river don't rise. Look, I have a concern I wanted to address before I get to your calls, and it was a result of something that I said last week about gender and gender dysphoria and the use of pronouns, and so I want to revisit that a little bit because I feel like I did not communicate well last week. And the confusion is my fault. I take full responsibility for it. Part of it is because I'm still working through these ideas and I'm trying to find the best way to express myself. And I settled in an idea, and I don't think I expressed myself very clearly last week, okay? I was talking about the challenge for Christians in the culture in dealing with gender dysphoria, which is a huge popular thing, I guess. I mean, it's odd to talk about it that way, but it is popular. It qualifies as a social contagion. In other words, it's one of these things that's not good if you have it, but it's gained kind of celebrity status. So if you have it, it's kind of cool. An example of a social contagion was cutting. So people who cut, that's not good. It's not healthy. It's dangerous. And people cut for reasons that are not good. In other words, these are symptoms of deeper troubles. And we can be sympathetic to that, but the cutting is not a good idea. And some people cut and almost die. someone that I know that was the case, cut really deeply in the shower, and that was almost the end of it. But so these things kind of take on some momentum in the culture, and for really odd reasons, become the cool thing. So it's cool to cut. It's cool to be gender dysphoric. It's cool to be bisexual. All of this is kind of cool stuff that kind of marks you out in a certain way. Now, people might think, well, cutting is it's too bad, but it's still a mark of distinction. Okay, so that's what we mean by a social contagion. It's a thing that gains momentum socially and gets contagious. So that's true of gender dysphoria. And so what had afflicted, and I'm using my words carefully, in fact had afflicted a very small sliver of the population, and brutally so, because it's a terrible condition for people to endure. The attempted suicide rate is 20 times the national average, and that's not just in this country. It's in much more left-leaning countries, same numbers, Scandinavian countries, etc. So it's internal. It's not socially driven, the impulse to try to commit suicide. People are deeply unhappy with something. And making a social transition to the next gen, the other gender, is not doing the job. It's not satisfying people, because that's not the real issue, in my opinion, at least. And as I've said many times, it's not possible to change your sex. Your whole body is sexualized in a certain sense. It is gendered, if you will. It is a certain sex, and every cell, virtually every cell in your body, broadcast this, and your body is made to support the sex that you are. Okay, now what can happen is changes can be made. There can be operations that you can have, or hormones you can take that will allow you to look more like the gender you are desiring to identify with. But so this is we've talked about this kind of stuff. It's a problem. But it is a difficulty for Christians who are strong in their convictions about what God has in mind and has to navigate in a culture that is very different and hostile, in fact, to extremely hostile to the Christian worldview. And this is a hostility we should expect when we stand for God. And the hostility in itself is not a reason for us to alter our convictions or behavior regarding those convictions, okay? And I talked about addressing this issue and thinking about three different categories, and one of those is the biblical category. In other words, what does the Bible teach? What does God say? And I take that to entail a description of the way the world actually is structured. That is, I don't need to read the Bible to know that sex is binary. And human beings are made that way. That's the nature of being human, male and female. It's how we reproduce. And so, but we know what grounds that, why the world is the way it is, and it's because God made it that way for a purpose. And I mentioned that it's really important for us to be square on the nature of reality and what God's purpose is regarding the world. And we can go back in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, Genesis 3, other places in the scripture that make it really clear how God formed the world with regards to human sexuality and gender. So we need to be clear first on what reality is like. Third, I'm jumping from 1 to 3 now. On the other side, we are dealing with this as a cultural issue, as a policy issue. And we need to argue for and stand for the nature of reality as God made it. It doesn't mean we have to be quoting Bible verses all the time. Part of what I was intimating a moment ago is if the Bible says it's true, it's because this is the way reality is, and just by paying attention to reality, we can figure a lot of this stuff out, and that's certainly true in the case of gender. Okay? But then in the middle, there's the personal challenges or the personal area. When you're dealing with an individual who is transgendered or making a transition socially, not biologically, because ultimately biologically this can't be done, as I said, but socially transitioning in their gender from, say, a male to a female, or vice versa, there are opportunities to interact with these individuals. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to clarify some points that I probably muddled last time around. And partly I've had some chance to think about it over the week. I also had an encounter in my own home with a transgendered person, and I also got some emails of concern about things I said last week that raised issue with the way I put it and what appeared to be the view I was promoting. So all of that, I want to thank those who sent emails, and I also want to clarify my own view. I'm not sure if it's going to satisfy everybody, but I'll try to be more clear about these things. My chief concern last week was dealing with and engaging with individuals in a gracious way. Now, one of the notes I got used the word cave 5 times regarding my position. I'm caving to the left. I'm caving to the LGBT crowd. Like, I just can't take the pressure, so I'm just giving in. Nothing is farther from the truth. And fast, when I read some of those lines to members of my staff, they burst out laughing because it's so inconsistent with me. I'm not caving to anyone. I have no fear of the left in that regard, that I have to appease them in some way so I could avoid their ire. That's not me. And there was some suggestion that my position lacked courage. Well, I respectfully disagree on that one, too. My points last week, as ineptly communicated maybe as they were not based on caving or a lack of courage in this circumstance. That's not what was going on. It was a desire to try to be gracious to individuals in circumstances, which then, by the way, if you put this all together, that on the one hand, we see God's view of reality, which is reality, and the second hand, we argue aggressively for God's view when it comes to the public square and policy. It simply can't be the case, then, that whatever I do personally is a result of me caving in or lacking courage or going along with the scenario of the LGBT crowd because I am trying to be gracious. It can't be said that I am offering my view because I am buying the lie that if we don't go along with the LGBT line of thinking, then we are being insensitive. No, I'm not going along with their line of thinking at all. And I do think it's possible for us to be insensitive on certain circumstances, and this is what I want to avoid, being unnecessarily insensitive. Now, here's the mistake that I made, or the lack of clarification I made last week. Although when we talked about this at our staff meeting, I did go into more detail on this and clarified. When it comes to using pronouns, one doesn't use pronouns with the person to whom he is referring. So I don't speak to Brooke, for example, and say, hey, Brooke, on the boards right now, hey, she, can you, give me increase my volume or something. Hey, her, I refer to as her name. Okay. So pronouns aren't used with the person in question. They are used when referring to the person in question. And what I said at the staff meeting is that I don't want to use the preferred pronouns when I'm talking to third parties regarding the individual in question. And I don't know why that would be a problem. And then the staff shot back, well, everybody's going to be mad at you if you don't use that person's preferred pronouns, even when you're referring to them outside of their presence. So I'm certainly aware of this distinction of using the pronouns regarding or using language regarding the person themselves in their presence and when referring to them. Okay? So whatever it is that I communicated on the air last week, let me just clarify for you right now. With regards to pronouns, I use the pronouns that apply to the actual sex of the person. So this week, there was a guest in our home, and this was a young lady that was transitioning socially, okay? I don't want to get too much detail because it's home stuff going on. But my practice was to talk with my family members, including her friends, including my daughter, who is her friend, talk to her, refer to her with the female gender because she's a female, female pronouns because she's female. And I explained to my daughter, this is what I would do. When it came to talking to her, I would use her name, whatever name it happened to be. I would use the name that she chose for herself. And I want you to think about this. What is my option in that regard? Let's just say, now I'm not speaking about the home circumstance, so I'm just going to make this general. Let's just say you meet somebody, enters your group that is transgendered. Okay, you know this individual is a female, but she's transgendering as male. She's dressing and acting as male, and people are using the him, he pronoun regarding her. Well, I wouldn't do that, and I don't recommend you do that either with other people. But what is his name? His name is Rachel. I'm just making this up. So what am I going to do? Your name is Rachel? But you're not a Rachel. Yes, I am. That's my name. But that's a girl's name. Yeah. But you're not a girl. Yes, I am. Well, what was the name your parents gave you? I don't know. I'm not talking about that. I don't go by that name. Okay, well, I can't call you Rachel, so I'm going to call you Fred. Because you're a guy. Okay, yeah. See, Brooke is like shaking her head like, are you weird or what? That's exactly my point. If a person has a name, it doesn't matter whether the name seems gendered one way or another to me. It's what they call themselves. It's how they refer to themselves. And I think we should use the name people choose for themselves. Look at, we have somebody on our staff named Ocean. And I'm looking at Brooke. Probably one day we're going to hire somebody named River. Who knows? Names are all weird. People go in all kinds of different directions, except for, especially nowadays. Brooke's not weird, Brooke. You see the point I'm making, though. So it would be mean-spirited and obnoxious and unnecessarily disruptive for me to find a different name that I thought matched the physical sex of a person different from the one that they prefer. I don't want to do that. So I'm going to call a person by whatever name they name themselves. What's my alternative? There is none, really. However, I'm not going to affirm the lie, as some have put it, of the changed gender by using the gender pronouns that someone prefers to have used of them when we talk to third parties. Now, if third parties don't like that and they get upset, okay, well, then I'm sorry. I'm not going to go out of my way to make a show of it. And if I'm talking about, say, Rachel in the presence of Rachel to other people, instead of saying him or her to them, it's just going to be probably more gracious to say Rachel and use that person's name. Well, here's what Rachel wants rather than here's what she wants when she's really a he. So you can see how I'm trying to navigate here in a way that honors the truth, honors biblical ideals, stands for what is true and right and good, yet at the same time communicates grace to individuals that I'm dealing with in a social situation. And that's what my heart is in the situation, is not to cave, really. It's not because I lack courage. It's because I'm trying to be, in that circumstance, make an adjustment that seems morally neutral, frankly, and one that I can't avoid because you can't invent your own names for other people. I'm going to call you Fred. No. No, I'll just call them by the name that they chose for themselves, even if the name is Ocean, which is a woman in our case. But River was the name of a guy, an actor named River Phoenix. And there's probably more Rivers out there. All kinds of boutique names available. I know that now because I sign books. And people give me all kinds of names I never heard of before. They got to spell them for me so I get them right. It's okay. So anyway, that's a clarification of my point of view regarding genders. I think it's a good, balanced view. I hope it's acceptable to my critics now that I've clarified, and I take full responsibility for being ambiguous last week, and maybe I was, even in my own thinking. But especially my experience during the week solidified my way I want to deal with this in my own life, and this is what I'd suggest to others. And keep in mind, though, this is challenging. We live in a challenging time, and what we're often trying to do is balance grace and truth. Okay? That's actually been our principle here at Stand to Reason, dealing with things like this. Jesus was full of grace and truth. And so a big part of our challenge as followers of Jesus in a diverse culture like this that is riddled with all kinds of confusion and nonsense, quite frankly, is to figure out how we can navigate with both grace and truth. Anyway, that's my desire. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. More after this.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
What comes into our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Everyone has ideas about God. Unfortunately, many people hold false ideas about Him. And these ideas have consequences. Some false ideas have led people to worship a God of their own making, while others have led people to reject God altogether. This year, we've devoted an entire conference to answering the most common false ideas about God. Is God anti-gay? Is God good? Do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? These are just a few of the topics we'll be addressing. The only way to guard against false ideas is to fill our minds with true ideas. So join me and a number of other speakers at one of this year's Rethink Apologetic Student Conferences. Find out more information about Rethink by going to rethinkapologetics.com. That's rethinkapologetics.com.
All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today. And let's go to Indiana and Steve. Hello, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. Glad to have you on board. What's on your mind?
Yeah, glad to be here having this question. So talking to an unbeliever, a family member, an objection was raised, and I might be kind of clunky in how I word it,
okay.
But I think I got the general gist.
Yeah, by the way, as evidenced by my opening commentary, I can do that
right.
too.
right. So the basic objection goes something like this. If the Bible is true, and the Bible started pretty much at the beginning of the world and the beginning of history, why does it seem like that from secular historical perspective, there are religions that kind of date ancient than, say, Judaism, like maybe Hinduism or ancient Egyptian religions?
Okay.
So it just seems kind of confusing to him, and I'm not really well-versed.
Okay, I've heard this kind of objection before, but think about the way the objection is kind of been characterized as you represented it, and it's if the Bible starts at the beginning. Now, Moses allegedly, apparently, wrote the account of the beginning, when he was with the Jews after Egypt. He's the one who wrote the Pentateuch, okay? But he's referring to the very beginning. He's not referring to a beginning at Egypt. The religion began when we came out of Egypt. No, he's referring to the very beginning when everything was made. So how can there be ancient religions before the very beginning when everything was made? That would be my confusion about the nature of the question.
Yeah, I get that, but I'm trying to put myself in his shoes. And 'cause I think, he thinks most religions just kind of borrow off each other. And, if the Egyptians started making writings and religion and mythologies first, then, Judaism came around and just kind of borrowed that and, I guess, backdated it in a certain sense. I think
that's a testable, somewhat testable. I mean, they're just because a religion, one religion comes before another, doesn't necessarily mean that the second borrowed from the first. Okay? Now, if there are similarities, there are different potential explanations for those similarities. So this is what your friend, let's just be charitable, best case scenario for him. It's a legitimate question and a concern.
Okay.
But then in responding to it, we say, well, there are more than one option. His option that he offered is Egyptian cosmologies came before the Jewish cosmology. Well, that's true. Okay. And arguably, Moses wrote Genesis 1 to describe a contrary cosmology. I'll tell you one thing that didn't happen is Moses did not borrow from the Egyptians in this regard because he made a very different kind of cosmology. In the case of the Egyptians, the sun was a god. In the case of the Hebrew cosmology, the sun was an object. It had no name. It had a function. Same with the moon. God made these things. And what Moses was doing, arguably at least, is showing the contrast. Now, because Moses wrote after the ancient Egyptian cosmologies, doesn't mean that his story, the beginning of the cosmology started there when the Jews were wandering in the wilderness or whatever. No, he's going back. He's saying this is the way it was from the beginning. So he is offering a competing cosmology, not a sympathetic cosmology at all, a competing cosmology about how the world began. Who wrote those cosmology first has nothing to do with their accuracy unless you are going with the idea that it's all nonsense and it's just a bunch of people writing stuff. But if it's just a bunch of people writing stuff, then nobody has any priority over anybody else. So whether they came late or early is irrelevant. And if that's, why would somebody presume that nobody has a fair or accurate take on the way it really happened? They'd have to have independent reasons for that. It turns out that the biblical account, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, comports, in my view at least, perfectly with Big Bang cosmology.
I'd agree with that for sure.
So there is a point, a touchstone, there is a evidential touchstone that we have given the account of reality that the Scripture offers. So I guess what I'd appeal to your friend with is that rather than just dismissing one over the other because one was written down earlier, given that the cosmologies are meant to identify ancient origins of things, and frankly, I don't even know if the Egyptian cosmology goes back to a beginning like Genesis does, a beginning in which there was nothing but God who then made everything out of nothing. That's a unique cosmology.
Okay.
For one, there's only one God. There's not a pantheon of gods. Secondly, he is creating ex nihilo, which as I understand it, and this isn't my forte, but as I understand it, the other ancient cosmologies didn't do that. And the other gods of these cosmologies and these pantheons are basically, I don't want to say glorified human beings, but they're like human beings. They have the same kind of foibles, and they look like something that was created by other humans. But that isn't the case of the God of the Bible. He's absolutely unique and stands alone. Now, of course, that doesn't mean our cosmology is true, but I think that what your friend is doing is just in a very shallow, frivolous way, dismissing these things without looking carefully at them. They aren't all the same. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm trying to think, I already know I'm going to play this call for him, and I'm sure he'll have more questions that I can maybe, you know, dive out a little
sure.
deeper as he sort of, you know, honestly, I think he's still kind of working through his objection. I'm just trying to gather the spirit of the objection.
Sure.
So I guess the big thing is, you know, the Bible talks about the beginning of the world that matches what we see in science, and that's completely unique among other religions. So that's one big plus. I had a question on the tip of my tongue, and now I
forget. That's right. The one thing I wanted to point out, and I'll explain something, and maybe your question will come back to you. One thing I wanted to point out is that there are some things that are repeated in other ancient stories, like, for example, the flood account. Virtually every culture has an ancient flood account. Now, this is resulted in sometimes people assuming, well, see, everybody's got one of these, and so therefore they're all false. And that strikes me as, everybody's got these kinds of things. See, that's just what people make up. Really, what would be the best explanation for the fact that most major cultures have some kind of ancient flood story in them? Would it be that cultures are just happen to be in the habit of making up stories about great floods where a handful
right.
of people are rescued? Or is a better explanation that there actually was a great flood in history and a handful of people were rescued, and that this piece of information was preserved down through time, even though there are variations as
right.
time went on? I mean, the fact that so many people have stories like this in cultures is an indication that it probably something like that actually took place.
Right. So
not the
I think
opposite.
He would, regarding that, I think he would say, and this is where I would need help with like the actual dating, if that's even possible, like Gilgamesh and things like
right.
that.
Gilgamesh epic.
He would probably say, well, somebody started this mythological flood story and they started borrowing this story as their own religion and et cetera, et cetera. So,
okay, but let me
I
respond.
Guess I could see that. Does one come first?
Okay,
did Gilgamesh, or does that?
Well, I think
that
maybe the Gilgamesh epic is more ancient. I'm not sure. I'm actually
okay.
not sure. But
okay.
it's not relevant. if what he's, this is a kind of, I can explain that kind of thing. I talk about this in the tactics book. Okay. He says, okay. So one person made this story up and everybody else copied it. All right. Now I understand your view.
Right.
Now I have another question. Why would you think that's the way it happened?
Right.
Why would you think that's the way it actually took place? What is your evidence that one person wrote it and other people copied it?
Sure.
You know, so you can't just throw an idea out there and with the prefacing it by saying, I can explain that, and then offer your explanation. You've thrown your gauntlet into the arena, and then you've acted like, well, not there it is. I'm done. No, you're not done. You just got into play. Now
right.
You've got to show us why that is a reasonable explanation of how it actually happened. What reason do you think that is what took place?
Yeah.
And
I guess a lot of it is probably his starting point. You know, if he's a, you know, atheist or strong agnostic or skeptic or whatever, I think his starting point is going to be highly skeptical of religion. So therefore, these stories sort of... them being shared sort of fits that narrative. Mm-hmm. So it'd almost be like a push, like it's not a point for him or a point for me.
Sure. Well, I can see it. Well, it's. I think there's a place for skepticism, obviously. We don't want to be incredulous. We don't want to believe without good reason, okay? But
right.
Then there is also kind of an unmitigated skepticism, which turns out not to be skepticism at all. It turns out to be a commitment to a very particular worldview that contradicts some other view
right.
that you're skeptical
right.
of because of your prior commitment. And so there
okay.
might be a commitment to atheism or to materialism or something like that, and that in light of that commitment, all of these other things seem farcical. So I just
right.
dismiss them all. But then the question then becomes, what is your justification for the thing that you're actually committed to and you're assessing these things in light of? I understand, as a Christian, I am assessing other things in light of my worldview, but I have independent justification for my worldview. I have good reasons why I think this is an accurate way of viewing the world. And so I'm going to take this accurate view, and what seems to be accurate, and I'm going to weigh contrary things against it. By the way, science does this all the time. It builds up a body of knowledge that it thinks is reliable for good reasons. Let's just put it that way. And
right.
when some outlier comes in, some fact that doesn't fit, well, people are going to be skeptical of that fact precisely because it doesn't fit in this body of information. Now, by the way, it doesn't mean that skeptical fact is in error, because science as a discipline is marked by major changes where things that people thought were locked in turned out to be almost completely false as broader views, and then they make a paradigm shift into a new paradigm. So you got to take these outliers seriously. However, it doesn't mean you have to abandon your own view. That is already well justified simply because you've got an outlier. So
right.
I'm okay. going to admit that I assess things in light of my worldview because I have reasons that it's well justified. But what are the well justified reasons for materialism, you know,
right.
or atheism
right.
or something like that?
Yeah, we've gone down that path a little bit about, you know, morality is an illusion, is free will an illusion? And we kind of worked through some of that. And I think he actually sort of admitted some of those things were illusions, which I was surprised he did. So
yeah.
I just asked him what is his bigger objection, and this particular issue came up. So
yeah, well, you know, if free will is an illusion and he admits it, then he would have then the fact would be that he is admitting it's an illusion in virtue of his determinism, and you are admitting it's not an illusion in virtue of your determinism, which means nothing either of you say has any meaning of any kind. You're just robotics acting out based on prior
right.
necessary and sufficient conditions. You're just dominoes falling. It's just amazing to me people who acknowledge that that everything is determined are still talking as if they're not. reasoning right. along and writing books about being determined and cashing the check for the, what they wrote. You know,
right,
it's like, come on. So I think people know better. But hang in there, Steve. Looks like you have a good conversation.
Sure. Hey, one last thing. Do you know of any particular resources on these ancient timelines and religions, or is that this just not a topic that comes up too often?
No, it does come up at different times. I just can't I'll make one reference, but I can't think of a particular book that deals a lot with it. Bill Craig, William Lane Craig, and his website, reasonablefaith.org,
okay.
I guess, he talks about these things a lot and in different questions. He's got a lot, he's a philosopher, but this guy knows so much about so much. It's just mind-blowing. And I would search on his website to see if he has dealt with any question like that. He's a great resource for that kind of stuff.
Okay, great. Well, hey, I appreciate your time, Greg. Thanks for talking.
No worries, Steve. Thanks a lot for the call. All right, let's take a quick break and come back with more of your questions on Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Okay, friends, Greg Kokel here, one of the good guys, equipping you to think every show. I have written down here every weekend, because this thing is like 20 years old. All this, I have these little sayings down here that I used to read when I did weekend radio for KBRT here in Southern California, and then things morphed as time went on, and I don't say all these things anymore, but once in a while. Scratching your mind where it itches. How about that? All right, we have more callers on, so let's go to Jose in Austin, Texas. Jose, ¿cómo estás,
yes,
señor?
Hey there, Greg. Muy bien. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Nice to talk
Great.
To you.
Likewise. I had the pleasure of meeting you at the New Braunfels Francis Schaeffer Conference for the last couple of last two times you went there, I think.
Yeah, well, I was there at the end of January this year with my wife, and she was in the back sewing and knitting while I was speaking. And then I think 3 years before that, I was at that wonderful event in San Antonio and staying with the Barry family, and that was great. So,
yes. Yeah, so no, it's been quite a pleasure and appreciate it. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So my question was just in light of kind of the current events with like COVID-19 and, you know, everything that's kind of going on with that. I had a friend who raised a neat interpretation of Revelation 17, 19.
Okay. Like chapter 17, then, verse 19?
Yes, correct.
Wait,
yes,
chapter 17 doesn't have a verse 19.
I'm sorry, 17, 9. Sorry.
Oh, 17:9. All right, got it. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains in which the woman sits. Is that the one? That's 17:9. Okay. 17, there were seven kings. Five have fallen. One is the other has not yet come, and when it comes, he must remain a little while. The beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction, etc. So and then the ten horns. That's the passage you want me to talk about?
Yes, and so the interesting thing was is that he had pointed out that Vatican City was established in 1929, mm-hmm. and that since then, you know, popes are technically the leading ruler of that city, and that technically there are eight popes since the foundation of Vatican City, which makes Francis the eighth.
Okay, Francis number eight?
Francis being number eight, correct.
Yeah.
So if you look at list of popes from 1929, there's, you know, Pius the 11th, and it just keeps going. And so that sets up the context of the question as far as, okay, this, you know, this is kind of current times, because when you get into Revelation 18 through, you know, you start hearing verses like verse 7 that talks about a nation that's lived in luxury, and then verse 8, for this reason, plagues will come to her in a single day, death and mourning and famine. So, you know, you can keep going on and on because it talks about death and it talks about merchants of the earth standing far away because they're not able to engage in commerce with this nation. So his thought was that's actually the U.S. And, you know, I'm kind of just wondering if you see any evidence of what's kind of going on recently with what's kind of lining right there in Revelation.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you candidly, I'm not a fan of Revelation, and all I mean by that is I have very little understanding of what's going on. It's a very tricky book. It's tied a lot to other apocalyptic literature, like the book of Daniel, some things that Jesus says in the Olivet Discourse, which is Matthew 24 and Mark 11 and Luke 21, I think. And so there's all these things that blend in. There's apocalyptic literature that's involved. And I just think that there are so many possibilities that it's hard to camp on any one spot. I've said for a long time, the only thing that I know for sure about the book of Revelation is a lot of people get hurt and we win in the end.
Sure.
So how all the details work themselves out, history is strewn with the wreckage of fanciful interpretations. I say wreckage because the time passed and predictive interpretations did not come true. So my general view there is then that the fulfillment is the final interpretation. I think with the identifying of Rome and therefore the Roman Catholic Church with certain individuals or imagery here, say in Revelation 17, is not new. People have done that before. I think it goes back to the Reformation, and there may be some truth to that. I don't know. I don't. It's very difficult for me to say, so I'm not weighing in. Like I said, whatever's possible is possible, and the fulfillment is the final interpretation. Now, I became a Christian 46 years ago, and one of the more significant early teachers in my life, who I had quite a bit of a personal involvement with and exposure to with him and his family, was Hal Lindsey. And Hal, you might know, he's still alive, I guess, but he's probably the most well-known promoter of a certain understanding of how Revelation is going to play out, et cetera, et cetera. And he was utterly convinced that the rapture was going to happen any day then. And of course, this is back in the mid-70s. I was single. Sure. I wanted to get married before the rapture. You know, it's the bachelor's to the rapture. Nope, not me. I'm going to get married. That's what we all wanted, all the single guys. But here I am 45 years later and 46 years and no rapture. And I don't hold that theology anymore, by the way. But the point I'm making is so there's lots of speculation, which is okay. As long as we hold the speculation with kind of a loose grip, the wars and rumors of wars and the earthquakes and all of that, Matthew 24, I mean, I remember Hal preaching on that and then giving statistics about the number of earthquakes that were happening, and this was a sign that we're moving towards the end. Well, I think that's all kind of gone away. And I just don't see all of those things happening the same way. As far as COVID-19, this is going to be gone in a couple of months. Trust me on this. Because when things get warm, flu dies. And once we hit the summer, it's just going to go away. In fact, it looks like, certainly in China and in South Korea, the viral infections have tapered off. Instead of 4,000 a day in China, they are now, 400 new occurrences of the disease a day. And so people are panicking like crazy. I'll talk a little bit about it probably at the beginning of next hour. But I don't have any reason to believe that this is a durable crisis or pandemic of any kind, frankly. This is largely created by the press, in my view, the sense of urgency and intensity about it. When you look at the numbers, they just don't deliver any rationale for the kind of behaviors that people have engaging in. Next hour, I'll read some things and just try to bring things up to date. So since I don't think that COVID-19 has got legs, I have no reason to think that's the case. Sure, wash your hands, that kind of thing, but I think it's not worth losing sleep about, frankly, unless you live in unless you're 90 years old and in Wuhan, China. Well, then you got some good reason to be concerned. So therefore, I'm not going to see it here in Revelation 18 either. So let's just wait it out and see what happens. Nothing wrong with speculating, but we always want to be careful. Make sense?
Got it. Okay. So is Hal Lindsey given any recent updates? Or has
I have not heard from Hal in decades, actually. The last time I saw him, he interviewed me on a book, Relativism, which I wrote 22 years ago. And that was on Channel 40, like the Trinity Broadcasting Network. So it was interesting to be reunited with him. But, I don't follow him. I don't stay in touch with him. I don't follow that kind of stuff. So anyway, thank you, Jose, for the call. And que Dios le bendiga. Okay. I will thank you for that. And gotta run. End of this hour. Wash your hands, folks. Don't get any flu if you can avoid it. I'll talk more about this in the next show. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven. Bye-bye.